received.
Thank you. Good morning, I'm Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Lance. To my left is Judge Scholin. We're here today in the matter of Barry D. Braun. It is a docket number 14-4085. Will counsel of the parties please note your appearance for the record?
Good morning, Your Honors. Landon Overby on behalf of Barry Braun, the appellant, from the law firm of Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick. And joining me at counsel's table is Jenna Zellmer, also at the firm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mark D. Gore for the Secretary. With me at counsel table is Deputy Chief Counsel Richard Bailey.
Thank you very much. Before we begin, Judge Lance would like to make a comment.
Good morning, all. Earlier, I was in the courtroom doing some administrative matters, and I saw the appellant, Mr. Braun, back there, and I introduced myself, and we shook hands, and I welcomed him to the court. Other than that, we did not discuss this case, but if counsel would like to recuse me on that basis, I'll be happy to do something else.
He's looking for a reason. are both parties ready to proceed? Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of my time, if I may.
You may, and you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The critical issue in this case is whether Mr. Braun, who is in receipt of 100% disability rating, permanent total, based on 1151 or 38 U.S.C. 1151.
Before we go down that on the merits, certainly, we have an issue with regard to standing. I think we asked you all to brief on. If Mr. Braun were to win here and go back down, is he filing a claim to be reimbursed for some expenses?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
Okay, then what is the importance of this case to him?
The importance is the status. So
she would still, his wife would still have to be the one to file a claim?
Correct, Your Honor. But the status derives from Mr. Braun itself. So if he has a child down the line, admittedly he does not have a child at this point, but if he does...
Well, if he did, couldn't he file at that time? Or couldn't, he could file on behalf of the child.
He could file on behalf of the child, but it's his status as the permanent and total disabled veteran who determines the status.
But if Mrs. Braun were to go in and file a claim, she's not precluded. This board decision has no effect on her, does it? It's not binding as to her, is it?
It would be, yes, Your Honor.
It would be.
Because they've determined that...
It's not a separate and independent claim that the individual would have?
I'm sorry?
It's not a separate and independent claim that would have to be reviewed independently?
It would be a separate claim, but the status itself right now precludes anyone from filing a claim because of Mr. Braun's status as determined by the board.
I didn't think any board decisions were precedential with regard to separate claims.
They're not.
Well, then how would it be binding?
Well, the status itself, Your Honor, is the binding aspect because once the board, if we had not appealed to this court, the board's decision would be final, and so there would be, it would require new material evidence, which...
Why would it require new material evidence for her if she were filing the claim?
Because they look at the veteran's status to determine whether or not she can actually even file a claim.
But wouldn't they have to redetermine that independently in her claim? In other words, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is the board decisions in his name have no effect on a board decision in her name or a claim in her name. I mean, they look at it, but they have to make an independent decision, and then she could appeal that.
She could certainly appeal it,
okay.
But they still look back at the fact that they've already determined his status as not being a qualifying status, and that's the ultimate issue here.
Yeah, I'm still having trouble understanding why that would be binding the board to the senior facts.
Is it akin to a determination prior to a veteran's death and then a surviving spouse later comes in seeking DIC based on whatever that determination was made? Does that carry over into the spouse's claim?
I don't know if it's akin to that, Your Honor. I think the way I would look at it is if the VA had determined a person who served in the military had an other than honorable discharge was not a veteran. So the benefits that carry from it, someone being determined not to be veteran eligible to collect benefits, it's the same thing. So here, if Mr. Braun is determined not to have that eligible status, which the board has determined, then no other benefits would flow from that. So the critical question for this court to address is the actual status of Mr. Braun. And getting back to that, under 1151, there's no distinction. It doesn't require an actual, whether it's quasi-service-connected or actual service-connected.
So similar to a determination that a person was or was not a veteran.
Well, the status, correct, Your Honor.
Counselor, on 6 June, the court ordered that the appellant's spouse be provided the opportunity to intervene. Has that happened to your knowledge?
Yes, it has, Your Honor.
She has intervened?
She has not intervened, but we have notified Mr. Braun's.
Okay, so she's had the opportunity to if she chose to?
Correct, Your Honor.
She chose not to?
Correct, Your Honor. We have not heard anything.
Thank you.
One of the arguments that the Secretary's counsel made was regarding third-party standing. Excuse me. And one of the criteria for that was, let's say Mrs. Braun were the appropriate appellant, but could Mr. Braun come in under a different standing theory? One of the things was whether she had an impediment to appeal. Do you think the way that the Form 9 is constructed, allowing only for the signature of the veteran, would be an impediment to her appealing?
It could be, yes. VA forms are not entirely clear, but it could be an impediment for her to appeal. But I honestly don't think that's the issue that needs to be addressed at this point, because we believe Mr. Braun does have standing because of the board's decision issued in his name and determining that he's not an eligible sponsor under CHAMP VA benefits or for CHAMP VA benefits. So if that status doesn't exist, then no one can ever utilize those benefits.
If this court were to dismiss his appeal and vacate the board decision, then would there be a preclusive effect as to him?
I think so, Your Honor, because once again, the status has been determined. If this court
vacated, if we vacated the board decision, though,
we'd still have to it'd start back at the beginning at the VA regional office, actually the CHAMP VA, which I think is in Denver, Colorado. They would have to go back and look at his status once again to determine if he is eligible as a sponsor for these benefits to flow. So even if the board's decision is vacated, we'd start the process all over again.
But why would they have to even do that if she has not made a claim? I mean, you said that he cannot make the claim for reimbursement. The statute appears to give the benefit to the spouse, not to the veteran. It derives from a status, but why would we take on a legal issue like this at this point without her being before us or someone who would ultimately be entitled to a benefit? It'd be like a third party coming in and wanting to argue veteran status for somebody. I mean, I'm struggling with this one.
So
you have a board decision. Let's talk about some other facts, too. You have a board decision. Your briefing appears to be that your client has been making this claim from day one.
The claim for the
status. And yet when we look at the, or when I look at the documents, it appears as though the applicant was Mrs.
Braun.
She made the claim with...
All right, so if she made the claim, she received notice of denial. He filed an NOD through the congressman.
Correct.
A statement of the case was issued in her name, mailed to him, and he filed a VA Form 9.
Correct.
So did it osmosis into his claim? I mean, I'm trying to figure out if it's her claim initially.
Well, the reason they denied, so she filed the claim, but the reason they denied is because of the status. They said that even though you're 100% permanently and totally disabled, you're not eligible to have the status. So that's when it kind of diverts to Mr. Braun at that point.
Let me ask it another way. As a policy matter, VA is apparently processing some of these claims or requests by veterans to determine their status for CHAMPA purposes. And in this case, forget the processing that it went through. We have a board decision stating status does not exist.
Correct.
But why should this court, which if it were to rule on this and deny that status and have a binding effect on a person who otherwise would be entitled, and the only one entitled to benefits, the spouse, who's not even before us, why should we condone determinations by the board, by the secretary, on status without the claimant being involved? What's the policy behind that? What's the policy reason for doing that? In other words, if you have a situation where perhaps an advisory opinion has gone out because it doesn't provide a benefit to him, a legal benefit, it potentially could provide it to her, but she's not there. So why is that being decided at all? And then why would this court step into that?
Well, this court should step into it because Mr. Braun received a final board decision that determined his status was not qualifying under 1781 because of his particular type of disability, and because he was awarded under 1151.
So how is he adversely affected by that? She might be, but how is he?
He's adversely affected because if, for example, she tries to file a claim for health care benefits to receive payment for treatment that she sought, then she can't do that at this point because, again, it goes back to his status.
But wouldn't that be her legal right being denied, not his?
Depends.
I mean, I admit we've gone through transitions in society and the family and the husband stepping in and doing everything, et cetera, but we have gone through those transitions. So we have a legal right in the spouse that exists. It's her right. It's not his.
Well, if I can make a question. In theory, Mrs. Braun is not the only beneficiary. She is actually in this case because they don't have children.
Correct.
But if he were to marry again or to have other children or to have children, then they could be potential beneficiaries as well. So if Mrs. Braun litigated his status and did it poorly or let the appeal lapse at some point, then potentially that determination, you're arguing, would be preclusive as to those later claimants?
I would think so, Your Honor. Because it all derives from the veteran, the status of the veteran. So if he has a child down the line, and it's no different than me as a disabled veteran, I step up and I try to file and they say, no, you're not eligible because you're not 100% permanently and totally disabled. Perhaps if I became 100% permanently and totally disabled, that would change the scenario, but it still requires a status before any claims can be made for any sort of benefits. So, and that's why we're here, is because Mr. Braun asserts that his status under 1151 qualifies him as an eligible sponsor for 1781 purposes.
Counselor, let's talk about jurisdiction for just a little bit. And, the appellant has no initial determination, and the spouse, the wife, has no board decision. How does this court have any jurisdiction?
This court has jurisdiction based on the final board decision issued in Mr. Braun's name.
But as to the wife, how does that work?
I admit that the initial decision was issued to the spouse, but ultimately the veteran appealed and the board issued their decision in the veteran's name, determining that he was not an eligible sponsor under 1781. So I believe that's what gives this court jurisdiction because, again, he was adversely affected, again, getting back to the status.
But we need a final board decision, do we not, in order to have jurisdiction pursuant to the statute?
That is correct, Your Honor, and I believe we have that in Mr. Braun's name, determined that he was not an eligible sponsor.
And then in that regard, how does this case differ from Mintz and Aleman cases?
Well, Aleman, and I'll address that since that was a more recent case, but Aleman, the distinction is the language in the statute, I believe it's 1922 in Aleman, says service connection determined by the secretary. Service connection is a particular status. I hate to keep on using the word status, but it is a particular status. So service connection determined by the secretary is quite clear, because service connection means something that was incurred during military service. And the distinction with Alleman versus Kilpatrick is the statute in Alleman was not ambiguous. The board admits here that the statute 1781 is ambiguous, the terms permanent total service-connected disability, and that's what gets us back to 1151 and what Congress intended. So Alleman is distinguishable because the statute was clear on its face, whereas here we don't have a clear statute, 1781. Excuse me.
Okay, so the crux of the case boils down to whether or not 1151 claimants should be given the same benefits as somebody who's shot in combat.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. I just want to make sure I was clear on that.
Now, if you are saying that the statute is ambiguous, is that your argument now?
The 1781, I'm saying that the board admitted that it's not clear.
But are you asserting that it's not clear? Are you asserting that it's plain on its face that he should get benefits?
I'm asserting that under 1151, that because of a permanent total disability, because that language, as if were service-connected, carries over to 1781. So we have to look at all the statutes as a whole.
Right. But 1151 was the same statute in Alleman. So the variable is the other benefit. Right, it's either the housing or the SDVI or in this case, CHAMP VA. So are you arguing that because the board found it ambiguous, you agree that it's ambiguous?
I think it is ambiguous, okay. Because it doesn't exclude 1151.
Okay, so if we accept that, let's say, then why should we not defer to the secretary's interpretation under Chevron?
Well, the secretary's interpretation, as we argued in our brief, I believe it just parrots the actual statute, the language. I mean, it's so once you parrot the language of the statute, then you go back to the Brown v. Gardner test.
Or do you go to Skidmore?
I don't think you actually go to Skidmore, Your Honor. I think
or Howard.
Again, it goes back to the statute. Okay. If it's just parroting the statute, then it goes to the statutory interpretation, and that's where the Brown v. Gardner and the Fishko test comes in.
Well, even under Brown v. Gardner, how is it ambiguous? I mean, if you look at 1151, let's just take a look for a second. Compensation under this chapter, which is Chapter 11, and DIC, under Chapter 13, shall be awarded for qualifying additional disability, blah, blah, as if such additional disability or death were service-connected. That's what 1151 says.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So 1151, when you look at 1781, secretary is authorized to provide medical care for the spouse or child of a veteran who has a total disability permanent in nature, resulting from a service-connected disability.
Yes, sir.
And there are definitions of service-connected disability, if I'm not mistaken, in this book.
There are.
And they do not include 1151.
It does not under 101. But
so why isn't this the Mintz case? Why isn't this exactly that? I mean, I know we had the Federal Circuit case, but they had an entire legislative history supporting an interpretation, et cetera, in different language than this.
I think that the difference here is if you look at the legislative history about 1151 and what Congress intended, especially in 1934, whenever they amended the World War I Veterans Act of 1924, they said that it should be treated as service-connected within the meaning of such laws. And actually looking at them, I believe it's cited at page 7 of our opening brief, Your Honor, within the meaning of such laws refers to all the other laws in which service connection is established. And I think VA recognized that, for example, in their precedent opinion, 80-90. And if I may, they said the pertinent language of Section 351 is essentially the same as introduced into the Veterans Benefits Law by Section 213 of the World War Veterans Act. So that language carries forward that within the meaning of such laws. So
is mens wrong? Is mens wrong? Is that what you're suggesting?
I would suggest that it is, Your Honor.
Okay, that's.
But I think this case falls more in the line of Hornig and Kilpatrick, and Hornig it looked at the precise language as if service connected, and I think that carries over for the purpose of 1781. That's where the ambiguity comes in.
So would you argue we have to overturn Mintz to decide in your favor?
I would think not. I think you can, I mean, we would have to call in the other judges, Your Honor, to be honest. But I think you can look at this and just like Hornig. Hornig looked at the language as if service connected. So I think you could follow.
Well, Hornig also looked at the structure of the Chapter 11 that it's part of, and Champ VA is under Chapter 17. So you don't have that benefit of conformity of the same chapter.
But we do have the benefit of what Congress intended with 1151, and that the benefits would actually flow from 1151 as if they were service connected.
So Congress didn't intend that in Alamein or in Mintz?
I think in Alamein and Mintz, I think the statutes were more clear. Here, the statute is not as clear. There are no further questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. At the outset, as the court began during the appellant's presentation, I'd like to begin with standing as well. It would be the Secretary's contention that based on the facts currently before the court, appellant does not have standing in as much or insofar as there's no injury in fact that has been established here. The benefit at issue here, CHAMP VA benefits under Chapter 17, are available only to spouses and children of veterans.
Why is the Secretary, I know this one looks like it's filed in her name and then converted, but I believe there's other board decisions where they also rule on the status, literally, that's the only issue, it's the veteran before them. Why are they doing that?
Well, to be fair here, Your Honor, the board did not decide appellant status. The VBA, the rating agency decided that when he was initially rated for his disability under 1151. That is just a rating that he has, and the status derives simply from the statute under which the compensation is awarded.
But the board, in this case, said he did not have status.
Well, the board here determined that his status, that's not in dispute, does not give rise to Chapter 17 benefits. Okay.
Why did the board render that decision at all?
It rendered that decision because the claim that was before it, you know, because it reached it and the board had jurisdiction over it, the posture in which it reached the board, admittedly, is a bit unfortunate here insofar as it misidentified.
I took the liberty of looking, and there are a couple other board decisions that are out there where they can't tell that there's a bad posture, how it got there. It just literally says, Mr. Veteran, you're seeking whatever status, and you don't have it. Why is the board rendering those decisions?
I can't speak for those other board decisions, Your Honor. I don't know which decisions.
So is it your view that you'd tell the Secretary that they should stop doing that?
In my view, Your Honor, if those situations mirrored this one where the claimant was misidentified.
What if it's just a veteran that's put in his claim, just like here, only he said he's the claimant, and I'm claiming status?
Then under those facts, Your Honor, no, the board should not be issuing those decisions under the incorrect person's name. Rather, they should be.
Okay, and they issued it under the correct person's name, the veteran. Everything was the veteran. Veteran said, I want you to declare my status. I can't claim it. I don't even have a wife. I don't have children. I just want you to declare my status. Why is the board going through and deciding those things? Why are you doing that?
Again,
there's nobody who has any benefit sitting out there whatsoever.
Again, Your Honor, that seems to be posing a hypothetical situation that we don't have here.
No, I gave it to you. I just gave it to you now, all right? I'm asking you why the board should do that. Because if they're going to go ahead and do that, then we have a board decision. If we have a board decision, why does he not have standing? The only reason he doesn't have standing is because she's not here.
Under the facts you've given me, Your Honor, the board should not be doing that. Simply asking for a declaration of a status would be akin to seeking a declaratory judgment of sorts from VA, which, of course, is not a claim for benefits. The claims refer to requests for benefits, and the benefit at issue would be the benefit deriving from whatever status.
Okay. So we don't have a claim for benefits. We have some kind of claim for status. and the board rendered a decision. We also have that kind of unusual processing in here. And your view is we should vacate the board decision.
Well, as to the way the court should rule on that question, it would depend on the way on whether the court finds that there's an injury in fact here. If the court does find facts here that indicate some injury in fact on the part of the appellant, then it would be the Secretary's view that the court does have jurisdiction here insofar as if there is an injury in fact, then appellant would have standing. There would be a case or controversy arising from this board decision and the misidentification of Mr. Braun as the appellant here rather than his wife would amount to little more than a clerical error, which this court encounters quite frequently.
So if we were to do that and modify it and put her name on top of this, what would we do? Have it reissued to her so that she could file an appeal if she wanted to?
I don't think that additional step would be necessary, Your Honor.
How would she appeal it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How would she then appeal it if we modified it and put her name on it?
Well, to be fair, Your Honor, if that's a difficult question to as to what the notice of appeal would be at this court. But in effect, what the court would be doing would be just simply modifying the board's decision to make sure.
Yeah, but if we go to the extent of modifying to put her name on it, we have to give her time to appeal it.
No, why are you saying modify the board decision, leaving his name, but we decide in his name here?
No, I would be suggesting that any modification by the court would be to put her name correctly identifying the claimant on that decision. But that would, of course, depend on her participation here insofar as she would need to intervene or rather substitute as the appellant.
Well, she's not here.
No, she's not here, Your Honor.
So then what do you recommend?
Under the facts as we have them now, I would suggest that the proper remedy would be to dismiss the board, to vacate the board's decision and to dismiss the appeal due to lack of standing. Unless, as I mentioned, the court does find some injury in fact and is able to fashion a remedy to ensure that the proper party in interest is before the court. But, again, that would require the court's finding of facts that the Secretary would submit are not present.
Well, getting back to it, if we go that route, you're suggesting we should set aside or vacate the board decisions.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counselor, wouldn't we accomplish the same due process, if you will, if we remanded this with instructions to issue a new SOC to Mrs. Braun and provide her the opportunity to appeal in her own name if she'd like to?
At this point, Your Honor, an SOC has been issued in Mrs. Braun's name. There's no.
I know. Did you say Mrs. Braun or Mr. Braun?
Mrs. Braun. The SOC was issued in her
name. Wasn't it mailed to him?
It was.
Okay.
But to my knowledge,
if he sent you back to square one and say, "Now do it right this time," wouldn't that preserve her ability to appeal to this court?
It would, Your Honor.
Okay.
But it would be. Assuming, because again we don't have facts to this effect, assuming that Mrs. Braun does maintain a motivation or desire to continue this appeal, and we have no indication here that she does, assuming that she would have the desire to continue the appeal, it's not clear what effect there would be in starting over from square one, as you put it. We have all the facts that are necessary to decide this case have been developed. It's a purely legal question arising from a fact that's not in dispute. So, again, if the court were to find standing here, it would be the Secretary would welcome the court invoking its jurisdiction here to reach the merits.
And didn't you just submit something recently about him not being a permanent service connection or something?
I believe you're referring to the Solzi notice submitted by appellant earlier this month, that there had been some conflicting notices issued to Mr. Braun with respect to his status as having a permanent and total disability.
Wouldn't that be a factual issue for the board to review, consider?
No, Your Honor. I actually am able to clarify that.
Okay.
In response to the court's order and the Solzi notice, I did personally check with the relevant stakeholders and authorities within VA and can affirmatively state upon information and belief that Mr. Braun is now rated permanent and totally disabled and has been since March of 1995 when he received his 100% disability rating under 1151. That has not changed. The rating decision in
So we have a legal issue before us, and your conversation or discussion is you're not sure it would change matters if we sent it back to square one. But what we're facing is a situation where we have a board decision in the name of the person who didn't file a claim. We have a claim that doesn't have a board decision. The statement of the case was in her name but mailed to him. And it seems to me, Judge Lance's suggestion, that you have to go back to that point so that she gets the statement of the case to present. And your point is it's a legal issue. And his point is we should decide it now because they're up here. And my point is if we decide it now and render a decision against him, it's binding on her, and she didn't even get the full process. That doesn't seem right, does it?
It certainly is anomalous, Your Honor. I certainly would give you that. But as I indicated, however, all the facts, all the laws is presently before the court. And all indications are that the misidentification of the claimant on the board's decision amounts to little more than a clerical error. And that is, as I mentioned, something this court faces routinely, and that can be corrected either by a corrective order from the board, leave the court under Laugen, or by simply modifying the board's decision to properly identify.
But we still have a notice of a statement of case not going to her.
Well, we don't have any indication that she didn't receive that.
No, but what we have is under the law, it was mailed to him. And we understand there's some separation or activity that has been taking place, so why would we presume that she got it? I don't understand why we would presume she got it. So let's presume she didn't because it got mailed to him.
If under that presumption, Your Honor, then I think we would indeed have a notice error there and that she wasn't. I think essentially what we would have is a Manlin-Kahn issue at that point, assuming that she did not receive that SOC. But at that point in the appeals process, their marriage was still in place. So far as the record indicates, the two were cohabitating, and it would seem, therefore, that she did indeed receive that.
Well, Counselor, you know, we have statutes and regulations and processes and procedures. I mean, I understand the attractiveness of both sides just throwing us at the court and saying, that's close enough for government work, but we don't operate that way.
No, Your Honor.
We should not.
No, we should not. And indeed, that is exactly your concerns that underlie the Secretary's ultimate position here, that Mr. Braun does not have standing insofar as he is not the party that has been injured by the board's decision.
Well, if I can back up to that. One, is he really not the claimant? Because my understanding of the initial CHAMP VA form has a spot for the sponsor, and then he's the one who signed the form. So is she the claimant or is he the claimant?
She is the claimant, Your Honor.
Then why does he have to sign the form? If she's the one who can articulate the benefit, she's the one who can apply for it, she's the one who gets everything, then why does he have to be involved at all?
I as to why there's a signature block asking for his name on there, I wasn't obviously...
I don't believe it does.
I'm sorry?
It just says whoever is signing it has to certify. And then he put in that he was a sponsor husband, but it didn't have to be the sponsor or husband.
Well, I mean, but I...
But just to get to his point, okay. It doesn't have to be. You do allow, I mean, you have to put the veteran's last name on, obviously, and then you put the applicant, which is her, and then someone signs it.
Looks like probably say the applicant.
It looks like anybody could sign it, right. To be honest with you, but...
And then the Form 9 says, you know, the veteran. It's got one spot. And so I think who the claimant is, I think, is ambiguous at this point. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
One minor correction, Your Honor. With respect to the Form 9 and there being only one blank, admittedly, I did misstate on the Form 9. There is a spot in Block 7 asking for the name of the person filing it if it's not the veteran. And that would be where the spouse's name should have gone on that. I did misstate there only being a single blank.
And also, the veteran doesn't have to sign it. It just says the person making the appeal.
That's correct, Your Honor. As to the claimant, I would reiterate again that it is Mrs. Braun that was the claimant here, insofar as she is the only person that could be receiving a benefit. Again, go ahead, Your Honor.
Well, I don't know that she's the only one receiving the benefit. Congress didn't create CHAMP VA for Mrs. Braun. They created it for veterans and a thanks to a grateful nation, or from a grateful nation, to people who are permanent and totally disabled and who can't necessarily provide health coverage for their own families, right? So this is really a benefit that Congress is giving to veterans, but the person who it extends to is the spouse or the dependent children. So is there really, you know, he's the intended, or assuming it applied to 1151, he's the intended beneficiary of this thanks of a grateful nation. It's not Mrs. Braun. And so I think policy-wise, it makes sense that he's receiving a benefit because Congress isn't necessarily doing this for other spouses and children. They're doing it for the spouses of these particular veterans.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, I respectfully would definitely disagree with your characterization of who the intended beneficiaries of CHAMP VA benefits are. The statute is clear and unambiguous on its face as indicating that these benefits flow only to the spouses and children of these veterans. There's no indication that any part of this benefit is...
Oh, I agree he doesn't get the money. What I think he gets is the knowledge that his family is taken care of, and that flows from his status of having a certain level of disability and it being total. So I'm not saying he would get any financial other than secondary financial benefit of money flowing into the household.
I would certainly agree that there could be some measure of benefit that he could realize in terms of financial gain or easing of financial strain, rather, and certainly peace of mind. But in terms of who makes a claim before VA, of course, no one makes a claim for peace of mind. People make a claim for benefits. And the benefit here is health care coverage, which is available only to the spouse and the children, not to the veteran themselves. So in the context of, I believe we're still in the context of standing, certainly one's not gaining some peace of mind certainly would not qualify as an injury in fact so as to give a person standing or...
So we mentioned the financial benefit that could flow. Why is that not an injury in fact, he's being deprived of that?
It could be, Your Honor, if we had evidence there was such injury here. And of course, we don't. There's no evidence in the record that any additional financial strain has been placed on Mr. Braun's finances. There's been no evidence submitted.
Does there have to be additional strain or just the absence of payments made for medical claims that would have been paid?
Well, again, Your Honor, we don't know if there would have been any such claims. We can assume them, but of course, it is an appellant's burden to establish jurisdiction before the court, and it's not proper to simply assume that these facts must be present. There needs to be some evidence that they actually...
Yeah, but you didn't get the evidence because you ruled against him on status. But even if you did have the evidence, what if Mr. Braun had paid these medical expenses? Can he file the claim?
No, Your Honor. He can, because the reimbursement, again, would be to the actual beneficiary of the benefit itself. Again, it would...
Now I'm getting back to the third-party idea.
I think the two ideas really are the same insofar as the assumption would be that if there was an unpaid medical bill on behalf of Mrs. Braun, that in the absence of her coverage, Mr. Braun would presumably have some role in paying that bill. But again, there's no evidence of that. And of course, there could be evidence submitted before this court to that effect, insofar as this court does have fact-finding jurisdiction to establish its jurisdiction, which is exactly what the situation...
Why would they give us jurisdiction if, in the end, he still can't file a claim?
Well, I'm sorry, I understand your question, Your Honor.
Why would that help us in our jurisdictional question?
Because he's a closely related party that has suffered an injury.
What's the injury?
Well,
this financial hardship that we've discussed.
But he still can't file a claim for it. Or can he? I mean, that's important to me. If he could pay, if he paid the bills and showed you I paid the bills, can he file a claim?
Again, he cannot file the claim. But the question with respect to this...
Well, he can't file a claim by saying I'm staying up at night because these bills haven't been paid either, can he? She has to file them, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. But what I'm getting at with respect to this court finding facts in support of its jurisdiction is just in furtherance of finding an injury in fact. If you do find an injury in fact that purportedly arises out of this board decision, you would have a final board decision with a party before you that suffered an injury in fact. You would have.
So, are you suggesting that mental distress caused by not being paying bills because his wife wouldn't submit a claim makes him a justice court jurisdiction?
Mental anguish, you're referring to?
He stays up at night because the bills haven't been paid, but his wife will not file the claim. He can't file a claim, he told me. Somehow he's legally harmed, in fact, so that we have jurisdiction?
Well, I guess I'm not clear on the distinction you're making between finding an injury, in fact, here and the ability to file a claim. I guess to kind of separate the two, what I'm referring to is an injury, in fact, with respect to this court's jurisdiction, separate and apart from...
How would his mental distress be an injury, in fact, that would give us jurisdiction?
It would... If indeed he did suffer some demonstrable anguish...
Except, How does it give us jurisdiction? I'm still having a hard time.
I'm sorry.
How would it give us jurisdiction?
It would give you jurisdiction insofar as, assuming you found it to be sufficient, there would be an actual injury in fact, which would give him status.
So we rule in his favor and his wife still doesn't file. How do we resolve his injury in fact? I mean, I don't understand. I'm not following. If he cannot file a claim, then all this mental distress and everything else is not a legal injury in fact that gives us jurisdiction, is it?
That really is the second half of the standing question, Your Honor. Once there was a finding of injury in fact, there would be a case or controversy before the court arising from a final board decision, which would give the court jurisdiction from a constitutional perspective. Then I believe what you're really referring to is the second half of that is really the prudential question. There would be jurisdiction before the court, and the question would become whether or not the court should exercise that.
For us, it's all pure prudential. We adopted that prudentially.
To be fair,
all prudential.
Yes, that's certainly correct, Your Honor. But with the recognition that it has been adopted, I believe the distinction would still arise, and that from the constitutional perspective, that's a jurisdictional question as opposed to a prudential one. Once there was a finding of the actual constitutional case or controversy, at that point it would be a prudential question looking to whether or not you had the real party in interest before you, which I think is the questions you're getting at right now, whether the person before you is really the right person to be asserting this claim, notwithstanding the technical presence of jurisdiction from a constitutional perspective.
Getting to what your opposing counsel was arguing that we had a little conversation on, assuming Mrs. Braun is the right person, but she either fails to appeal and the board decision became final, or came up here and did a really poor job, to what extent would a decision by this court or leaving a board decision standing regarding her ineligibility because of his ineligibility preclude future claimants, like subsequent children or subsequent spouses or whatever, from seeking similar benefits?
Well, it certainly wouldn't preclude anyone from seeking a benefit. The analysis would proceed exactly as it did here. A claim from presumably a future child or a future new spouse would come in. There would be the same inquiry made from the Health Administration Center to the Veterans Benefits Association. And that inquiry would simply be the nature of the underlying disability.
Well, wait a minute. If this court ruled that he did not have status,
in a precedential decision.
Yes, in a precedential decision. There's no authority for anyone to second guess it down below. He can go up, but down below. So they would be bound by it, so it would be a different analysis.
Well, that's correct, Your
Honor. Now, if they had a board decision, I had this discussion before, if they had a board decision, would they be bound by it, or would they go through that analysis?
If there was merely a board decision, Your Honor, then that's the situation I was referring to, and that the analysis would proceed exactly the same. However, if we're referring to a precedential decision by this court, the situation is a bit different. And again, it gets back to the distinction I referred to earlier, in that the board did not decide status here. The board decided.
So restate for me again. I want you to be very clear, because I think you're in opposite with your opposing counsel. If it's a board decision, what effect does it have on a claim by a future child?
The board decision would not have preclusive effect. Again, the determinative issue is not the supposed status that Mr. Braun has. The determinative issue is the undisputed nature of his disability as compensated under 1151. And the real question that was before the board and is before you now is whether that type of disability compensated in that manner is capable of giving rise to Chapter 7.
I think that's what we're calling status. You're calling that something else. But so if that issue, whatever we're calling it, is that issue, and it was decided by the board that anybody who filed a claim pursuant to Mr. Braun's sponsorship was not eligible for CHAMP VA in the future, would that board decision affect that question?
The board decision itself would not be determinative insofar as board decisions are not precedential. However, if we're referring to a decision by this court here, then that certainly would affect future claimants, both under Mr. Braun's sponsorship and under anyone's sponsorship, insofar as the court would be deciding the legal question.
Presumably a board decision, although not binding, not legally binding, might be persuasive to the adjudicators below.
That certainly could be the case, although
But then that could be appealed to this court.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Then that could be appealed to this court.
An underlying rating decision, yeah, it certainly could, Your Honor.
Counselor, I'm going to give you a question that you probably had anticipated and are prepared for.
I hope so, Your Honor.
Tell me the difference and similarity in this case between Kilpatrick and Hornick.
They're both readily distinguishable, Your Honor. I'll start with the more straightforward of the two, which would be Hornick. Of course, there, this court has determined that the protections under 1159 are available to veterans compensated under 1151. And it would be my contention, Hornick, that the protections in Hornick and 1159 arise directly from Chapter 11 compensation. Of course, it's in Chapter 11. And the protections under 1159 are intrinsically a part of the compensation arising from Chapter 11. If a veteran has service-connected disability compensation, after 10 years, that's protected. That's part of the nature of the compensation. If 1151 recipients did not have that protection, there would be a fundamental distinction between the two types of compensation. And Congress explicitly said that there needs to be congruity between the two. So the Hornick decision really just arose out of the fact that it's the nature of Chapter 11 compensation. Kilpatrick, on the other hand, was the distinction is what the Federal Circuit observed in Aleman. It's the same two distinctions that are present here. Kilpatrick really arose out of the historical peculiarities underlying the specialized housing benefit. And as the Federal Circuit observed there, where you end up really is a product of where you begin. And where that analysis begins is 1948. At the time the specially adapted housing benefit was created, the precursor to Section 1151 at that time had a specific enumeration of statutes where those benefits went along with the 1151 type compensation. One of those statutes was Section 701. And the specially adapted housing benefit arose under 701 paragraph G. So at that point, at the advent of the specially adapted housing benefit, those benefits unequivocally were available to 1151 type recipients. And there's no indication anywhere in the historical record to indicate that Congress ever intended to take that benefit away. And indeed, as the Federal Circuit explained, the evidence is strongly indicative of exactly the contrary. Congress in 1957 specifically indicated in floor debates and in legislative committee reports that they intended that to be kept. And that's just not the situation we have here. CHAMVA arose in 1973, and at the time it did, Section 1151, or rather its precursor, Section 351, read exactly as it does today, referring to Chapters 11 and 13. And the CHAMVA statute, 1713 at the time, 1781 now, then as now referred specifically to service-connected disabilities. And Section 101 at that time, just as it does now, specifically defined service-connected as a disability arising from an injury incurred or aggravated in the line of duty in active service. There's no ambiguity in that, and there's no indication that Congress ever intended this benefit to flow to 1151 type recipients.
Now, aren't you glad I asked that question?
if there are any further questions on the merits, Your Honor, I'd like to conclude. The board's decision is legally, factually correct, and it would be the Secretary's contention that in the event the court finds jurisdiction, that decision should be affirmed in all respects.
What's your position on jurisdiction is that we do not have it because of lack of standing?
At this point, given the facts before it, it would be the Secretary's position that there is no standing and therefore no jurisdiction.
And therefore, the board decision should be set aside and vacated.
That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few points, if I may. I think Mr. Braun, to answer your question, Judge Castle, could make a claim. So if he actually paid the benefits, the portion is about the statute itself is that there has to be a dependent, so a spouse, a child. But I think clearly that Mr. Braun can actually make the claim itself and be reimbursed by the VA.
That to me was a very important question that you originally said couldn't, so he didn't get an opportunity to respond to that. And why do you say he could when the statute says?
The statute speaks to dependents. So it's not a matter of who can make the claim. It's a matter of who's eligible for these benefits.
Well, it actually specifically says spouse. I don't even think it says dependents anymore. But where is it, 1781. The secretary is authorized to provide medical care for the spouse or child. So why do you say that anybody, I suppose your theory would be that the hospital that didn't get paid could file a claim too?
I would believe so, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you have any support for that?
I don't, Your Honor.
But go ahead.
The critical issue, again, is getting back to the status. And if there were a final board decision saying that Mr. Braun does not have the eligible status because of 1151, that would be, if he has any other child, spouse, dependent that comes along, the VA...
So are you agreeing that we should vacate, set aside that board decision?
I agree you should set aside the board decision because the board's wrong on the legal issue about the status. But getting back to my point, though...
So if we were to rule in favor of the government, affirm the board decision with regard to status, disagree with you, without her being here, is she not a necessary party? Is she not an indispensable party? I mean, she's not even theoretically before the board, which is the decision in his name. She didn't even get notice of the statement of the case. And you want us to rule on this board decision, on this issue, that could be against your client, and absolutely bar her, who's here today, or any future children?
She wouldn't be able to even apply for the benefits without his status, and that's the
only... No, but she can apply for the benefits, and then they can determine the status, and then that can be brought up.
And that's what they did here.
Would you agree that we should modify the board decision, put it in her name?
You could modify the board's decision, put it in her name, but...
Okay,
the
then how would, he have how would we have jurisdiction?
Well, presently you have jurisdiction because the Board of Veterans Appeals issued a decision in his name. But if the Board of Veterans Appeals, just putting something aside, if they issued a final decision on the actual status, which they did here, that gives this court jurisdiction, that is, while they're not precedential, it is final and binding. So unless there's clear and unmistakable error, that decision attaches for whatever dependent. That's what I'm ultimately getting at, is that his status, because under 3.105A, it talks about disability, age, dependency, line of duty determinations. Once those decisions are made, whether if he didn't appeal a regional office decision, didn't appeal a VHA decision.
But they're made in conjunction with someone who claims, right? In other words, the veteran claims something and then a status determination is made. What we have here is someone who has no claim. He just wants a status determination, which goes back to questions I asked, why are they even doing this? But anyway.
But ultimately, like I said, it gets back to the status of the veteran. That's what's really controlling here, is that no one can ever make a claim. Well, they can make a claim, but they're ultimately going to be denied because he doesn't have that status as determined by the Board of Veterans Appeals.
But if we just dismiss this case for lack of standing, even if we left the board decision in effect, even if they used the board decision even if they said they were bound by the board decision, that could all be appealed. And then you could have the issue addressed, yep, judicially, with a party who has a true interest in the claim before us. So it's not like they can. They might have to go through the process, I agree, but they ultimately could get to court. The concern I think you're hearing is he's got a board in his name. The claim was in her name. This thing's really messed up, and she's not here. We got a mess.
I understand your concerns, but again, ultimately it revolves around his status. And we believe that under 1151 and 1781 that he does have that status.
And you want us to rule on that issue. You want us to take this board decision, find jurisdiction without her here, and rule on it. And if we rule against it, that's okay. Well, you're going to say it's not okay. But if we rule against
it,
she's bound by it. And she wasn't even here. I mean, you're not finding that to be a problem?
It would still go back to the veteran's status. Even she could reapply, and it's never going to change.
She can reapply, but she's got a decision here that said that she can't get benefits. So she's never going anywhere with that. Res judicata.
I understand that, Your Honor.
Somehow. I mean, maybe she argues that she wasn't a party here, in which case then we wasted our time.
I again,
but this has been fun, so don't misunderstand me. We haven't wasted our time. So good issue.
There are no further questions, Your Honor.
No, thank you very much. The case will be submitted. We will come down and recounsel.